Grace and peace to you all, and welcome to the Calvary Road with Pastor Sam Allen.
You find yourself in a trial, you don't get the job, or you lose the job, or you get demoted on the job, or they promote some guy who's 20 years younger than you, or whatever the case might be. That's just the trial, you see. That's not the temptation. The temptation is, well, maybe you used to have a drinking problem, but you've been doing pretty good because you've been kind of, you know, rising up the ladder. You're making money. Things are going good. And now the temptation will come. Am I going to fall back? Am I going to revert back? Am I going to go back?
Only with Jesus. Only with you.
Well, hello and welcome to another broadcast in our series from the book of James. Today's text begins with the statement, "Blessed is the man who endures temptation." And on our study today, we're going to consider the source of temptation and how one may endure it, considering we're probably not going to completely avoid it. So, let's listen in.
James chapter 1, we pick up at verse 12. We're looking at verses 12 through 18. James 1, 12 through 18, overcoming temptation. James 1, 12 says, "Blessed is the man who endures temptation. For when he's been approved, he will receive the crown of life, which the Lord has promised to those who love him. Let no one say when he is tempted, 'I am tempted by God,' for God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he himself tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when he's drawn away by his own desires and enticed. Then when desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is full grown, brings forth death." You know, of course, in order for physical conception to take place, two things have to come together. You have to have the seed or the sperm, and you have to have the egg. And when they come together, there's conception. There is the beginning of life. Well, James, just like Jesus, takes what we understand in the physical, in the natural, and he uses it to teach us about that which is spiritual and supernatural. He knows that we get physical conception, and he wants to teach us about spiritual conception. Now, it really happens in two realms. There is the genesis in this passage of both death and life. And he begins here talking about death. The service will conclude with us looking at the genesis of life, how that happens, the seed that's planted, the egg, as you we'll see, that God has placed within us, that wants to receive, that desires to know him. But in any case, today we begin verse 12 with the beatitude. Blessed is the man. Those words, blessed is, 46 times in the New Testament. Blessed are, 45 times in the New Testament. And literally, blessed here means, oh, how happy, or oh, how fortunate. It's always used in the context of a superior blessing an inferior. And the picture here is God is a God that loves us and wants to bless us. In fact, he is blessing us. He says his sunshine shines on the good and the bad. His rain falls on the grateful and the ungrateful. God's blessing every person on the planet. The difference between someone who knows him and someone who doesn't is we're grateful to him, that we're thanking him for his blessings, not oblivious to the fact that they come from him. Now, he says there's a special blessing reserved to the one who endures temptation. To endure means to persevere, to press on, to keep going, even under pressure or persecution, trial or tribulation, and here, temptation. Our last study had to do with trials. And what we're going to see is that trials often brought on by the Lord that he might, well, we saw it. He brings trials so he can mature us, so he can prove us, so he can test us. Not so we'll fail, but so we'll pass. And he strengthens our faith, and he builds patience, and he matures us, and he causes us to trust in him even more. Temptation, though, often accompanies trials. And temptation, well, we see the Lord never brings it. We're never to say, "I'm tempted by God." God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he himself tempt anyone. So where do temptations come from? Well, Satan is one place. The world is another. Just circumstances and situations can present temptations. But here's the deal. God's purpose, God's plan, is that trials will develop us. Build, as I already shared, character and maturity and patience and all of those good things. The enemy watches and strategically attacks at the point where he sees, well, we're a little down because we're going through a trial. We're a little insecure, unsure because we're in the middle of a test. He knows that's a time when temptations will, have a road in. And so again, the enemy's lies, the world's allurements, they happen at those times where we are most vulnerable. Now, God's plan, again, always to do good through all that happens, even as he allows temptations. Romans 8:28 says he's using all things and working all things together for good to those who love him and are the called according to his purposes. But Satan's plan is to tempt us and get our eyes off the Lord or our attention off God's word. Here are a couple illustrations and it'll help make this clear. Israel. They're at the edge of the Red Sea. You know, it wasn't just Moses had problems with direction. God had led them out and he was leading them even now. He leads them to the edge of the Red Sea, mountains on each side, Red Sea in front, Pharaoh's armies behind. They're trapped. That's a real trial. And you got to see it. God was using it to demonstrate that he was for them, that he was going to open that Red Sea. Now, they don't know that. They're in a real trial. The enemy comes, and here's where the temptation would be. The insinuation, if God loved you, why would he bring you in a situation like this? If God's for you, well, what's the enemy doing behind you? If God, you see, the temptation comes from the enemy. The temptation would be to doubt, to despair, to confusion, to complaining. Joseph in Egypt. What an amazing story, his story. Hated and rejected by his brothers, sold into slavery, ends up in the house of Potiphar, falsely accused, put into prison. This is really summarizing a guy's life story, but he's in prison and you got to see it. The whole trial, not every individual little bad thing that happened, but the big picture of all he was enduring, God was in. And Joseph actually gets it. When he stands before his brothers and they're afraid of how he might deal with them, he says, listen, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. He sent me ahead of you to save many souls alive. He saw the big picture. God's in the trial. He's not just allowing it. He's orchestrating it. Well, then where's the temptation? Bitterness, anger, vengeance. You see, Joseph, just like us, would look at his circumstance and his situation, and if he didn't have his eyes on the Lord or didn't put his trust in the Lord, he'd think, man, this should never have happened to a man like me. I didn't do anything to deserve this. And bitterness, it can creep in. And then anger, and then I'm going to teach him a lesson. I'm going to pay. If I ever get out of here, I'm going to make them pay. That was the temptation. None of that's from the Lord. The trial, yes. The temptation, no. Gideon, we looked at him a couple weeks back in our study and Wednesday nights. We're going through the book of Judges and it's been a blast. Great stories. God whittles down Gideon's pretty wimpy army to begin with to 300 men. They have a multitude of Midianites they're going up against. And that trial brought about again by the Lord. But what's happening on the other side of that? The enemy. I'm not talking about the Midianites. No, the enemy of our souls whispering in their ears, you'll never be able to do this. Look at you. Look at them. You're outnumbered. You're under-armored. No, it doesn't matter. God was for them. God was with them. God was going to do an awesome thing. In any case, what happens with us? Same thing can happen. You find yourself in a trial. You don't get the job or you lose the job or you get demoted on the job or they promote some guy who's 20 years younger than you or whatever the case might be. That's just the trial, you see. That's not the temptation. The temptation is, well, maybe you used to have a drinking problem, but you've been doing pretty good because you've been kind of, you know, rising up the ladder. You're making money. Things are going good. And now the temptation will come. Am I going to fall back? Am I going to revert back? Am I going to go back? And for some, it's drinking, others, it's drugs, others, it's pornography or whatever might capture a heart, a soul, a life. You got to know if you're going through a trial, you're vulnerable. So you need your armor up. You need to be thinking clearly. Lord, I know you're with me. I know you're for me. I know the enemy's going to try to do me in, to take me down. God's going to strengthen, but the enemy's going to attempt to defile, to divert, to derail, to discourage, to destroy. In any case, he makes a promise, and I love it. He says, when he's been approved, Now, my old New King James, I don't know there could be such a thing. Sounds like an oxymoron, but it exists. My old New King James says when he's been proved, and maybe you have a Bible that says that same thing. The New King James is actually an improved. It says approved. And all it's doing is making clearer something that might, well, we don't always say when he's been proved. It means tested. When he's come through the test, the man who's endured temptation, he'll be approved. And then he'll receive the crown of life, which the Lord has promised to those who love him. Get this, it's not just enduring, but the motivation for enduring that he's rewarding us. Well, what's the motivation? Not just fear of what'll happen if I fall. Not just, well, what might happen if I don't succeed. No, it's, I love you, Lord, and I trust you. And I'm going to get through this with your help, your strength, your wisdom, your power. I'm going to get through it, and I'm going to glorify you in the midst of it. He says there is a crown awaiting you. Now, we don't wear a lot of crowns. I mean, unless you're like a Burger King person or something. But, you know, it's sort of unusual in the 21st century. But in the first century, crowns were a big thing. I mean, they wore them at athletic events. Today, if you go and you compete, they give you a medal. You wear it around, you know, something around here, and it hangs off. And you're like, I got the gold or I got the silver. But in those days, they gave you a crown. And there are a whole lot of crowns in Scripture. This particular crown is given to those who endure, who make it through temptation, and they do it because of their love for and confidence in the Lord. The only other place this particular crown is mentioned is when Jesus tells the church at Smyrna, who was experiencing great persecution, great tribulation, so much so that at one point he says, listen, be faithful unto death, and I'll give you the crown of life. He doesn't say you're not going to die, but he says you're going to be rewarded. You're going to die. It's going to happen. But on the other side, a crown, and this crown, because you've loved me and because you've glorified me in the midst of your suffering. Now, the first time crowns are mentioned in the New Testament, and I found this interesting, four times. First four times, the crown of thorns placed on Jesus' head. And I'm thinking, we're going to share in communion. And how important is that, that we put it together? You know, there would have been no crown of thorns had there been no sin. And it certainly wouldn't have been on the head of the only perfect man to ever live, tempted, as we'll see in a moment, in all ways, yet without sin. No, thorns were a part of the curse, and the curse came because of sin in the garden. And here he is wearing, as it were, a part of the curse on his forehead as the Roman soldiers mock him, King of the Jews. Now listen, he's more than that. He's King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And he wore a crown of thorns. There's an imperishable crown mentioned in 1 Corinthians 9:25. For those who run their race, and Paul likens our experience as Christians to an athletic endeavor. We're running our race. We run it lawfully. We train adequately. And then we run to win, not just to finish. He says, we're going to obtain an imperishable crown. It's going to be there. Then there's a crown of rejoicing for those who, well, look at others and say, man, you are our hope. You are our, you in the presence of our Lord at his coming. That's the crown of rejoicing. Then there's the crown of righteousness promised to those who love his appearing. And if you're looking forward to the second coming, if you're looking forward to being with and like Jesus, he says he's got a crown awaiting you for just that. Then there's a crown of glory, which he promises to those who shepherd his flock, a crown of glory that does not fade away. Well, when it gets to temptation, and we got to get to the process itself, he says, let no one say, verse 13, when he's tempted, I'm tempted by God. God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he himself tempt anyone. Temptation, like trials, are certain. There are three things I wanted to point out as it would relate to this particular section. Well, at least a couple. Maybe we'll just go two of the three. Temptations, like trials, are certain. The words there in verse 13, let no one say when, not if. We saw last time trials are absolutely certain. And now he's saying temptation is absolutely certain. We will not escape it, so we must endure it. We won't escape it, so we have to overcome it. We're going to be tempted. The second thing is God is not the source of temptation. We read it. He can't be tempted by evil. He doesn't tempt anyone to sin. And a question at least comes to my mind, and certainly to some of yours. It's a bit of a paradox, an apparent contradiction, because we know Jesus was tempted in all ways yet without sin. And Jesus is God, God the Son. So if it says God can't be tempted, how is it that Jesus was tempted? Or was he really tempted? Or was the temptation real? Or could he have actually yielded to the temptation? A whole lot of questions, but here's the essence of the answer. The deal is Jesus as deity could not be tempted with evil. It's good news, by the way. It means nobody can tempt the Father, even Satan, to nail you or take you down or give up on you or, you know, nullify his promises to you. It'll never happen. But Jesus in his humanity, because he really became one of us, you know, the early church fathers had it right. Truly God, truly man, fully God and fully man. And as a man, he could be and was in fact tempted. We know it because it says tempted in all ways, yet without sin. Now, I talked to somebody last night about this, and he was a little confused. So here's the thing. We don't want to think, or I'm not trying to suggest, that every possible evil thought we could think or every evil activity we could get involved in, that Jesus experienced a temptation to that. I haven't even experienced all temptation. There are just some things that aren't tempting to me. There are some sins that are so gross, I have no interest in them. There are other sins, and you know this is true. Well, they don't appear to be exactly what they are. In fact, we tend to paint sin in such a limited way that when you're a brand new Christian, you know the biggie's got to go. You know what they are, and if you don't, well, we'll read them to you later. But as you walk with the Lord for a while, you realize, man, my attitudes, my ambitions, just the everyday way I live my life, those things can be sin. Well, all that to say this, when Jesus was tempted in all ways, it doesn't mean every single temptation that could ever come. It just means that, well, you've been tempted to depression or despair or discouragement. He was too. You've been tempted to not believe or not trust or not keep just looking to the Father to provide. He did too. Every human experience we have, loneliness and anxiety and fear and depression, those are common. And Jesus would have had all of those feelings and experiences. But here's the thing. When tempted, he never succumbed. He never gave in, tempted in all ways, yet without sin. You're probably aware food can be a major temptation. It's strange to some people, but you got to know it's not a 21st century phenomenon. And I'm not talking about just overeating or eating the wrong stuff, you know. I'm not talking about the person that starts a day with a dozen donuts and then gets a pizza to wash it down, you know. But no, food can be a temptation. How do we know that? Turn these stones to bread, Satan says. Now listen, Satan's smart. He's sly. He goes about, we're told, like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. He comes as a subtle serpent. And when he comes at Jesus, suggesting, take it into your own hands. Listen, you don't have to wait on the Father. You don't have to trust the Father. I'm not adding those in. It's really the essence of what he's saying. Take it in your own hands. Meet your own needs. Use your power for your own purposes. Make these stones into bread. You can do it. Now, Jesus was truly hungry. It's essential that we get this. 40-day fast. There's a point, and I don't know exactly where it is. I never fasted 40 days. Never thought that would be wise. But I do know something about fasting, and I do know that when you initially fast, you're just hungry and starving, and all you can think about is food, and you wonder, what kind of spiritual discipline? I'm not eating, but all I think about is food. But you get to a point. For some people, it's a couple days in, and other people, it's 3-4 days in. But somewhere in there, you get to a point where you no longer care about food, and you realize, man, I spend so much time preparing and then eating and then cleaning up and shopping and all this stuff, and now I'm just focused spiritually. Well, here's where it goes. When you get hungry again, it means you really do need to eat. And for Jesus, he made it all the way to 40 days. Now, the enemy doesn't come day one saying, why don't you turn those stones to bread? He'd say, why should I? I'm not even hungry. No, he comes 40 days in, you see, when the need is real, it's genuine. And he says, why don't you take things in your own hand? Why don't you turn the stones to bread? Why don't you? And Jesus, and learn from it, He deals with this temptation as he deals with all temptation. Three simple words. It is written. But food, we'll come back to that. Food, it seems crazy that Satan would tempt people with food. But listen, it worked with Esau. If you studied his story with us, he sold his birthright for a bowl of stew. It worked with Eve. Yeah, she saw the tree was good for food, pleasant to the eyes, and a tree desirable to make one wise. And she took and she ate and she ate and gave to Adam, and he ate too. We know she was deceived, but the deal is she should have known better. It was food. She was tricked. No wonder we're not ignorant. We're told we're not ignorant of his devices. We know how Satan works. We see his MO. He uses it over and over and over. Did you know that rest can be sin? No, I'm not suggesting that all rest is sin. Certainly not. Food is a gift from God. Rest is a gift from God. Exercise. And you know, in fact, we're going to read before we conclude this study. Every good and perfect gift comes down from the Father of heavenly lights. And here's what I've learned. If God blesses us with something, creates something and makes it available to us, the enemy, because he's not a creator, he's a destroyer. God gives us sex, Satan wants to pervert it. God gives us food, Satan wants to make us a glutton. God gives us rest, Satan wants to make us lazy and useless. He takes God's good gifts and he tries to pervert them and twist them. God gives us his word. And Satan and the cults grab it and they twist and they distort it and they pull it and they stretch it and it no longer even resembles what God gave us. And you got to see it. Because Satan can't create. All he can do is pervert and twist and distort and manipulate and all that. Resting surely isn't a sin. But there are times where resting can be a sin. When Jesus was in the garden and he takes Peter, James, and John further, deeper into the garden, and he says, stay with me, watch with me. My soul is just, he was just going through the worst trial he would ever face. Jesus was going through it. He knew the cross was ahead, and he prays, Father, if there's any other way, let this cup pass. And he comes back and he looks at his disciples and they're sleeping. And he says to him, and I'm convicted by it, couldn't you watch with me 1 hour? Couldn't you just pray for an hour? I remember when I was young and I thought you had to be on your knees to pray with your eyes shut. And I used to always pray, and it was pretty much the same, you know, real short. Now I lay me down to sleep. You probably prayed it, but you know, and that whole thing. But anyway, if I tried to get lengthy in any of it, all that happened is I'd wake up at some point, had no idea when I fell out, but I'd have a big kink in my neck. I'd be like, oh, man, this doesn't work for me. So I've learned for me, and I'm convinced of it, God doesn't care about our posture in prayer, not our physical posture, our spiritual posture. Yeah, he wants us to really acknowledge, yeah, I'm really talking to you and I'm listening for your response. It's a communication, a conversation.
I love that Pastor Sam declared what our prayers with God truly are. He told us that we're having a conversation with God when we pray. And I want to touch on a few things regarding that idea. First off, prayer requires faith. Faith that not only someone is there listening to you, but also faith that he's going to care about what you have to say. Hebrews 11:6 tells us, but without faith, it's impossible to please him. For he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. So, would prayer be a way that we can come to God? Would it be a way that we can diligently seek him? Absolutely yes. As a matter of fact, I can think of no other way to come to God outside of prayer. So prayer is a genuine and practical way you can exercise your faith. And just like a muscle, the more you exercise it, the stronger it gets, and the more it grows. And the more our faith grows, the more we learn what to pray, and the more we learn to listen to Him. And this changes us. It changes us into a person who prays for things that align with God's will. And the more we do that, well, that's when we truly begin to see our prayer life change our relationship with God. Just like any good conversation grows, any relationship with anyone that you love.
The Calvary Road is a ministry of Calvary Chapel Chico, and you can visit our website, ccchico.com, or download the CC Chico app to contact us and listen to other studies from Pastor Sam. You can also listen to The Calvary Road as a daily podcast by visiting thecalvaryroad.com. We'd love to hear from you. And until next time, may you find grace and peace as your journey takes you down the Calvary Road.
And your grace.